you know beams? That whole first day, it was crystal rope. Did you know beams about that?
Not really. But that's the other thing about the Gordon Tunnel. You may not know beans about it. And in fact, after we got going, what we tried to do is have maybe three topics, two or three topics, so that even though you're doing research in topic number one and don't know beans about topic two and three, it was felt, it still is for that matter, that you should be aware of what's going on, topics two and three, and one way of doing it is to go to the Gordon Conference. And one of the rules is that if you go to the Gordon Conference, you're expected to stay there the full week. And staying there the full week exposes you to that area of chemistry that you know little or nothing about. And it has worked out very well. It also is true, I think I mentioned this already, it brings in outstanding people that younger people look up to and feel it's really worthwhile to, for example, have lunch with such a person, because they're having meals together. Sooner or later, if you want to meet one of these people, it's easy. And these people are expected to stay also all week. I think that rule is broken down. A lot of things have changed. I'm sure you will hear about it. And it's the beginning, at least, of inorganic chemistry. Because the Gordon Conference started quite early.
That territory of crystal growth, which was in inorganic chemistry, did that did solid state and semiconductor stuff come out of?
I think it must have. Yes, that's an area I know little or nothing about, but I think that's correct.
There's another day was spent on electron deficient compounds. I'm not sure what that would be or what that would mean. Do you know what that was?
No, I am not sure what it was either. But there are compounds which are electron deficient. You're supposed to have maybe 18 electrons and you only have 17 or something like this. And the ones that are electron deficient are generally much more reactive than the ones that are not. The ones that are not are more stable. So there are examples of electron deficient compounds.
Can you give me an example or two? I'm just wholly ignorant about what.
Well, I'm not all that knowledgeable about the examples. But in organometallic chemistry, there are compounds that are not all that stable, and in the process of going from one compound to another, you have to go through some system. And what you do if you go through an electron deficient compound, that makes the reactivity such that the compound is capable of reacting in the direction that you want it to.
Another day was spent on inorganic fluorine compounds. What's sexy about inorganic fluorine compounds?
Well, fluorine is a very corrosive and very reactive element. And even now, you have to be careful how you work with it. In the Manhattan Project, for example, all of these places that were centrifuging the gases, uranium fluoride, to concentrate the isotope that is a compound. It's the isotope that's needed to make the bomb. The isotope of the uranium, for example, And they did this by having it make a gas with fluorine, so that the fluorine is so reactive that that's something that can be done with fluorine, but it can't be done with chlorine, for example. So there are things that fluorine is used for. This is the one that's best known, I guess.
So that day might have trenched onto atomic energy, radioactivity, those sorts of
territories. No, I doubt it, because early on people were talking about things like that. Maybe some of the stuff with the Manhattan Project was still classified. This fellow, George Cady, was at the University of Washington, I think. And he was one of the few people doing chemistry with fluorine. Mm-hmm. However, I should really say that, because people who in the Manhattan Project were doing fluorine chemistry, and these people, when they left the Manhattan Project, many of them went into academic positions, and in their academic positions they continued to do fluorine chemistry. So all of a sudden fluorine chemistry became quite important. A lot of things have been done with it.
And then the other day was on coordination compounds. What's sexy about that?
Well, the sexy is the fact that I do it. No, seriously, coordination chemistry, since you guys are in history, in fact, I should tell you about this. Way back when, in the early 1800s, I guess, or early 1800s, there was this guy, who made a lot of these compounds. They are very interesting, they have different colors and so forth.
This is Werner?
No, that Werner, I'm getting to Werner. This is Jorgens. S.M. Jorgens, S.M. Jorgens in Copenhagen, made these compounds with his own two hands. He analyzed them and everything. And I spent a year with my family and I on sabbatical and worked in the same lab as S.M. Jorgens. He had a whole cupboard full of these compounds. And Jorgensen had a theory, which was referred to as chain theory, and used that theory to guide him in making the compounds, and he was very successful. And it took about 100 years or so before Alfred Werner came along. And Alfred Werner was trained as an organic chemist, but he was intrigued by all these colors that these coordination compounds had. And so he, and also intrigued by the fact that people didn't understand too much about them. And so he started having a look at them, and finally ended up with this coordination chemistry theory. And that was 100 years later, really. The first compound made, I guess, was Tesseret, who was a Frenchman. I don't know that he ever published another paper, but he did publish this paper. It was 1700 in 89 or something like that. And Werner's thing was in 1930, so he got the Nobel Prize, so it must have been 19-something, early 1900s.
Why did you get into it? Were you in... Your Roman passport wasn't on coordination.
No, no, not at all. When I went to Illinois, I found there that the professors they had, most of them were very good. And
it however happened to be organic chemistry. And they only had two or three organic chemistry. And I, when I did my undergraduate work, it was just a teaching place. And there was a member of the faculty who really kind of looked after me, and we got along very well, and he was an organic chemist. And so when I got to the University of Illinois and had to decide, I decided that I'd like to be an inorganic chemist, even though these giants of organic chemistry were all there. And all the graduate students practically were doing organic chemistry. And I talked to, as graduate students do, talked to three or four of the inorganic chemistry faculty. And in every case, I came away feeling I didn't want to work with such a person. And then I did find John Baylor, who not only was a good chemist, but he was a good guy. His graduate students, and that intrigued me so much that I went to work for him. He was an organic chemist who became a coordination chemist. And you know, the coordination chemistry now involves almost, well, really involves mostly all the metals. These groups, you know, attach themselves to the metal. Might hold two groups, might hold four, might hold six, and so forth. So there's an awful lot of work that goes on, such as the work that's being done here, you know, in terms of what we're being doing.
So John Baylor, as an organizer of 51, got a day on coordination compounds.
That's right.
And put his star graduate student on first.
Well, I don't know how that happened. But I didn't even know that. When I was writing the book, fortunately I hadn't thrown everything away. So I looked through what I had and came across this. And the way it looks like that's when inorganic chemistry started. And it also looks as though I gave the first talk on organic chemistry. But you guys can find out, because I'm sure the Gordon Conference will give you all the historical information that you need.
Who were Martel from Clark and Douglas from Penn State? Were these Baylor students or who?
No, they were almost Baylor's age, I guess. Yeah. Martel is in bad shape at the moment. Fernelius passed away some years ago. Of course, Blade Baylor also passed away a few years ago. So.
Did coordination compounds become a staple subject in the inorganic conferences? I mean, was it one of the subjects year after year?
Yes, I think so. In some way or other, it might not just have been called coordination chemistry, but in the chemistry that was being discussed, you can see that there is coordination going on. In fact, now they a very important field, a very important area, that is bioinorganic chemistry. So the chemistry that some people are doing, or on biological systems, for example. Even work that I did, I haven't gotten to that part of what I'm going to put in here, but we ended up with finding out that cobalt was a synthetic oxygen carrier. Nobody had ever noticed that before, and we started working on it, and before very long, we ended up with something like we call it cobaglobin. It's like hydro It's like the biological system itself. Instead of having iron in it, you have cobalt in it. So, and that's coordination chemistry, just like hemoglobin is, you see. So,
inorganic, that's a separate conference that came out of the inorganic.
Oh, yes, yes, inorganic chemistry now has gotten so large that there are people who are suggesting that we no longer should have an inorganic organic conference, because inorganic chemistry now is bio-inorganic chemistry, it's organometallic chemistry, it's several areas of inorganic chemistry, and we should just simply have Gordon conferences in these special areas. Now, some of the old timers, like myself, and I keep mentioning Dr. Curry because he's been doing wholesome. But anyway, like myself, keep insisting that no, we shouldn't go and have these specialized Gordon conferences, even though it is true that organic chemistry could break itself up half a dozen different conferences. And our argument is that we'd like to use this Gordon conference to make the point, and also to have people get exposed to different areas of inorganic chemistry. At the moment, we're still doing inorganic chemistry, in addition to the specialized inorganic or non-organic.
In the early 50s, when people speak of inorganic chemistry, and certainly before that, it's a field dominated by German scientists.
Oh, yeah, sure.
In the early 50s at the Gordon conferences, are people coming from Germany, or are you really drawing people from North America?
Well, we didn't have any money to finance anybody from abroad, so we weren't getting all. Occasionally we'd get one or two, and eventually this did pick up. But when I was a graduate student, for example, I didn't know any German, but most of the, as you say, most of the inorganic chemistry was being done in Germany, and they were making compounds. And in our research, my research, there were times when you would like a compound that had been made, and they would publish in journals which are in German. So you would have to do the best you can if you wanted to make that compound. And it got to be possible to do that, even though I didn't know any German. All I could do, though, really, was to go to the experimental, in any case, that's what I wanted to do, and recognize some of the words, mix this with this, and then give the formulas for the reactions, and so mm-hmm. forth. But that's what they did, and it turned out that they were really concerned with making compounds, and they couldn't care less about how or what happens as these reactions take place.
Mm-hmm.
I think I made it, well, certainly mentioned it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I got in this area working on chemistry because as professor looked at me, and at that stage I was a young man, in my laboratory we do real chemistry, we don't do philosophy of chemistry. I was about 35 years old at the time, and that prompted me to do the chemistry in that area, which turned out very nice because nothing had been done, and we were able to publish, and the graduate students were able to come up with original work for the thesis.
So, yes, a lot has happened. I mean, since
were a lot of grad students, or were any grad students coming to the early inorganic conferences?
I think practically none.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it had to do with travel expenses mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. Even the faculty people, we would write letters to them and kind of beg them to come if they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make the sacrifice and come. But I don't think there have been, may have been an occasional graduate student. Whereas now, graduate students come and I think they pay less of a registration fee. And in fact, the Gordon Research Conference now has developed into a real business like you guys, where they have quite a bit of money. And they give this money to graduate students to, offset. They don't pay all the expenses, but they mm-hmm. certainly pay enough of their expenses to make it attractive to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's attractive to them for other reasons. Perhaps. When they are almost completed their research, and they're probably even doing postdoctoral work, but want a academic position, one way of doing it, and it works quite nicely, is to go to a Gordon conference and meet someone from some university where that university has an opening
mm-hmm.
for a new faculty person. And this young person the other can get to know one another,
mm-hmm.
and the older person in the department can also conversations with him, find out what the younger person is interested in doing
mm-hmm.
and how capable he would be
mm-hmm.
To do this. I've helped two or three of my students over the years exactly that way. I would introduce them to someone from such a university, and by the time the Gordon conference was over, they got to know one another very well.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys did indeed get positions at universities where they had talked with the faculty members. So there are lots and lots of things that the Gordon Conference does.
Did you hire people to Northwestern on that sort of method?
I just don't recall that we did it that way. The answer is, I think not.
Mm-hmm.
I think not. I think what we did was we'd go to meetings and we would be impressed with what was being presented, and the person who presented whatever it was, research that he was doing, and then if two or three of us in the faculty agree that this person is doing very nice things and he understands what he's doing and so forth, we would invite him to come and give a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, the entire faculty would have a chance to talk to him and listen to his seminar. And if that all went well, that's the person that we would make an offer to.
Right.
So, a variety of ways, of course, coming up with new faculty.
Sticking with the inorganic conferences, did you end up chairing any?
Yes.
Yeah.
If I recall, I chaired at least a couple.
Mm-hmm. What was your experience like in terms of deciding who would get to come and how to send out invitations? And
well, it depended, of course, on what was happening in the organic chemistry, which was a primary interest, and who was doing it, and so forth. So you sit down and work out a program, and then send it around to a couple of people to have a look at it and to make suggestions. No, I wouldn't have this. You probably forgot to do that, and so forth. But the person who has the chair is competent enough to really come up with a program with little or no help, I think. And it's their responsibility to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say that 1 year that wasn't done, nobody paid attention to the chairman, and by the time they needed that information, it was just too late.
Mm-hmm.
So they canceled the Gordon conference.
Right. Now the go ahead.
Well, you guys appreciate this, I'm sure. The Gordon Conference, when I was, I think, chair of the Board of Trustees or something, I don't know whether it was exactly that, but anyway, when I was on the board, I was looking at all these applications, you know, for starting a new conference, and we try to evaluate these and so forth, and depending on the nature of the conference and so forth, you either approve it or don't approve it. And the number of people going to, or the number of conferences, not the number of people going to, the number of conferences before I left had reached 100, almost exactly 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made the point that they shouldn't go much beyond 100 if they're going to keep these conferences the way they had them.
So you mean in terms of the number of participants, not the number of conferences?
No,
the number of conferences.
Number of conferences.
Okay.
There are lots of different areas of chemistry, so that they were mm-hmm. conferences in different areas. And however, I also, in order to, it was quite apparent that people were going to these conferences who were not even chemists. They were physicists, or they were something else. And since this is a conference that's supposed to be a chemistry conference, I also try to point out that that was happening, and some kind of arrangement should be made to prevent that from happening, at least to a large extent. And in order to do that, the application form, I convinced people on the board that we should have a question, maybe quite, and it turned out to be about a third question or something on the application, is how many research chemists are working in this area. And some of them had no chemists working in this general area. There they were physicists, you know, and they're biologists.
Mm-hmm.
And I was suggesting that they shouldn't have this. Well, everything's gotten to a point where now the Gordon conferences are all over. They got one or two places in Italy, they got something in Germany, they had one in London. When I was writing the book, I wrote a short paragraph about the Gordon conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they were having these conferences and setting it up in different countries, different places. So I called up Carl and said, would you please read this part of the autobiography, because it has to do with the Gordon conference, and tell me if there's anything wrong with it. And he said, gee, this is great, except that we have just established a new conference in Singapore. And I said, Singapore? Christ, there's no chemistry in Singapore. I was there, you know, once at university, and I had a seminar. There was a handful of people. But, of course, there's islands around or whatever, and people have no opportunity to have these kinds of conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So they started a conference in Singapore. They had conferences every place. And that was not in tandem, but that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the inorganic conferences, I gather they were initially very much sort of self-funded out of the dues and what people paid for it.
Oh, yes.
And then at some point, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, OSR, kicked in.
That's right.
What's the background behind that?
Well, I don't remember exactly how that happened, but in those days, the atomic energy, so-called atomic energy, people were putting some of their money into research. The Air Force Office of Scientific Research was also they also had some money to support basic research. And I was one that was involved, and this guy, Lenny, who was a member of the staff of Air Force people, and a couple, two or three others, Doc Perry, a few others. I don't know exactly how it all came together,
mm-hmm.
but at some point, the Air Force was giving the Inorganic Gordon Conference funds to help support the conference. And it came to a point where it was routine, dependent on the conference, dependent on getting that much from the Air Force. And that was very helpful. And then later, if you read that chapter of the book, I think it pointed out that that had to be stopped, because by that time, the Gordon Conference was in pretty good shape,
mm-hmm.
and could even kind of support itself.